Charlotte's preparing for 50,000 visitors this fall. It's not for a football game or a music festival, but for the Republican National Convention.
But how will the RNC impact Charlotte? And that means you.
Join me, Lisa Wharf.
And me, Steve Harrison, for the Inside Politics podcast, where we cover the RNC and the 2020 election through the lens of Charlotte.
Listen to Inside Politics now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and WFAE.org/insidepolitics.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, we are 6 weeks away from the North Carolina primaries, and this week, Democratic Senate candidates came here to debate. You may have missed it. We didn't. We'll tell you what they said. News emerges about Panthers officials making campaign contributions to area leaders in advance of MLS discussions. The CMS Equity Committee holds its first meeting, and the system talks about its latest crisis, a security system that doesn't work, who's to blame, and what to do about it. And Catawba and Cabarrus counties declared themselves Second Amendment sanctuaries. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to talk about those and other stories, and seated around this table are Steve Harrison, political reporter for WFAE News and co-host of WFAE's new Inside Politics podcast, which is now available at a podcast proprietor near you. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike.
Annie Ma is a reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Glenn Berkins is here. He's editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. Hello to you.
Good morning.
And Nick Oxner is chief investigative reporter for WBTV News. Good morning.
Just like Larry David, I'm back. Hello.
Yes, you are. Hold the language. A couple of years ago, Senator Elizabeth Warren, now running for president, called on Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf to step down during a Senate Banking Committee meeting because of the shenanigans that had allegedly, well, it's proven now, that were going on at Wells Fargo over the years. And yesterday, I believe it was, John Stumpf, the former CEO, was hit rather handily. What did they do to him?
So it's a $17.5 million fine, and which I believe is the largest to date. The federal government is still seeking a larger fine against one of his subordinates, but $17.5 million in a lifetime ban from banking. And I think it's interesting. I mean, these are not criminal charges. You could argue he still got off easy. But I think it is a shift in terms of after the financial crisis, no one was really held accountable. Like, institutions were held accountable. Fines were levied. But no one was ever called out. No one was ever punished. And this is at least an instance, really the first time in which one person.
Yeah.
And this was action taken by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is kind of an obscure federal regulatory agency that plays a big role in regulating banks. And a lot of people in Charlotte know about it because it controls a lot of their lives. Interesting to me is, in addition to the one subordinate Steve just talked about who headed up the bank's consumer banking division, who's still contesting the allegations against her, the OCC says they're going to continue their investigation into this, and they might bring future actions as part of this investigation. So this is pretty serious and ongoing.
And evidently, Kerry Tolstedt, who is also high level at Wells Fargo, is looking at a possible ban from banking and a $25 million fine, more than the CEO. Why more?
Well, because she was the head of the unit that was carrying out these practices. And that's the subordinate that we just mentioned who's currently still contesting that.
So the root cause was not necessarily, I'm sorry, Glenn.
No, go ahead.
The root cause of this was not necessarily the financial crisis, although I suppose it could have helped lead to it in some way, but it was the fact that they were putting names in customers, they were putting accounts in customers' names, and the customers had not opened those accounts.
Right.
All for sales goals.
Right. Old story with this bank. They've been hit a number of times for doing things like that. I want to go back to something Steve said. I don't want to give short shrift to the fact that no criminal charges have ever been levied in any of these banking irregularities, whether we go back to the housing crisis or we're talking about this. To be sure, $17 million is a lot of money, but these guys make a lot of money. Giving back $17 million, while I'm sure it's painful, it's not devastating
Did the bank claw back any money, any compensation from these executives who were let go because of this?
Well, the bank has said that they're going to stop any future payouts to these executives. I don't believe I've seen anywhere that they've said they're going to claw back money.
And I don't know how old John Stumpf is, but he was the CEO, and generally CEOs have been well compensated for years. A lifetime ban from banking, will that impact his ability if he needs to earn a living?
It keeps them off boards. So the ban is from anyone regulated by the OCC and from serving on any boards of institutions that are regulated by the OCC. So it keeps them off board service, which is a pretty common thing for retired executives to do and can be very lucrative. There's that kind of impact, but hard to say.
Okay. So last year, CMS began installing a security system in light of a series of school shootings around the country and because guns being found on some CMS campuses. I think the district spent, the figure changes every time I read a story about this, around $1 million, $1.3 million so far on that security system. And it turns out, as we talked about last week, it doesn't work. The system was bought during former Superintendent Clayton Wilcox's administration, but it was current Superintendent Ernest Winston who told us that the testing proved it was undependable and in some cases didn't work at all. And then he said something last week that raised some eyebrows.
You may ask me, whose fault is this? And the answer is, it doesn't matter.
Well, this week, Ernest was a little more circumspect and a little more measured.
Everything that occurred was legal and followed board policy. In terms of who's at fault or who to hold accountable, what I want to convey is, as you alluded to, I inherited this particular situation. My job is to bring about resolution to the matter.
So in terms of legality, this multi-million-dollar system was not purchased through a school board decision or approval process. It was purchased through a series of purchase orders, which are generally for smaller purchases. And they did break this million-dollar thing down into little chunks in purchase orders. That may be legal, but it's very unusual. Did he have anything more to say about that?
So the comments that you guys just heard came during Ernest's address to a joint Board of County Commissioners meeting and a CMS board meeting. He didn't make himself available for questions afterwards, so we weren't able to ask more or push back on that. But so what he said is sort of that it followed board policy. You know, former board chair Mary McRae told The Observer that she felt like this was a terrible way to do business, and she blame CMS staff. She said she wasn't aware of what was going on and that the board didn't have any oversight of this because they weren't aware that these decisions were being made at the time. So there are still questions about that.
And Mecklenburg County Commissioner Trevor Fuller asked Ernest Winston at that meeting about spending so much money using purchase orders. I think there were 27 purchase orders, I believe. And Winston told him that the school board had, quote, begun to have conversations to ensure that we're not in this same position going forward. What does this say about how CMS has been operated over the years? Is this the first time this has happened, or do we know?
I think there's a lot about CMS and the way it operates. We've talked about this on the show a lot, right? We have questions for board members. We have questions for administrators. It's hard to get any of those questions answered. Annie and Fred have done a great job in their series, finally diving into something. But it's a large, large bureaucracy with a lot of opacity.
Yeah. This week, County Commissioner Vilma Leek boiled all of this down to three questions.
Who signed the contract? Who leaked it to the press? And who do we hold accountable?
So let's go through those questions. Who signed the contract? This system was purchased with purchase orders. Winston has said there is a contract between CMS and Syntegix. Is that how you say it?
That's what I've been saying.
That's the name of the company that did the system. When WFAE asked about a contract, a CMS spokeswoman said there wasn't one. But at a county commission meeting, the Charlotte lawyer who is representing Clayton Wilcox was there on her own time, not for Wilcox. And she said that she has seen a contract signed by the district's chief technology officer, but that she could not provide a copy. So is there a contract, Annie, or is there not? And if there is one, why hasn't it been produced?
So there's no contract in the sense of how we understand government contracts to work, because we asked if they had a contract routing sheet, which goes with all of those documents. They said they didn't have one. There are various service agreements and legal looking documents that may have been signed by various CMS administrators, but in the sense of like, did the board enter a binding legal agreement as an entity with this company? There's not a document that outlines that. When Ernest is talking about being able to recoup the funds or the contract that kind of outlines what they're being provided, I believe a district spokeswoman told me that he's referring to the request for proposals language, which has the standard CMS terms and agreement to bidders. And one of those clauses is that, you know, if you don't give us a working product, we're going to get our money back. So that's what they're leaning into.
So then do we have recourse? Is that company liable? Must they fix this and make it work to our satisfaction? Or do we get our money back if they can't do that?
I am not a contracts lawyer, but like reading through the language of that, it does say, you know, if the CMS is unsatisfied with the product, we'll get the money back. So there seems to be some weight in there, but it's also says like per the out, I don't remember the exact wording, but it says like, if you aren't delivering according to the contract document. So if there's no contract document, it does feel like a flat circle of like ideas chasing themselves. So possibly not. You'd have to call a real lawyer for that.
So when Phil Malik asked about who's to blame, that's when Ernest Winston said that he wanted to focus on the resolution. But this is the second time he's deflected that question about blame. Do we know why?
I have no idea why. You know, since the, I can't speculate to what Ernest is thinking, but since Clayton Wilcox left the district, CMS has leaned into this message of like, we're trying to move forward, we're trying to go on to what's next. And so I wouldn't be surprised if it's part of that.
So the second question Phil Malik asked and wants an answer to is, who leaked it to the press? Why is that a relevant question? Had someone not leaked it to the press, we wouldn't have been talking about it. We wouldn't have known about this. The leaker, I guess, could be considered a whistleblower. A good thing in some circles, not so good in others. So didn't the Observer break this story?
We did, yeah.
Did somebody leak it to you?
Well, I don't talk about sourcing about my stories.
Come on, it's just us.
In the sense of like leaking it to the press, much of what we got was through public records requests. Like by law, they are required to hand that over to us. So I don't know that necessarily constitutes a leak.
I just think that second question about the leak was kind of mind-boggling. After especially what we've gone through with impeachment and the whole whistleblower thing, like we've just had this huge civic lesson on, you know, a bureaucrat standing up for what they see is right. And you know, Velma didn't really say it specifically, but I don't think she wanted to know who the leaker was to give them a ribbon. Right. That was kind of the
just
lines.
A reminder that Donald Trump is not the only politician in America who comes down against leakers and transparency.
When they unveiled this security system back in August, it seems that they talked about some of the other school districts that had a similar system. Do we know if the other districts are having similar problems?
I was going to ask that question. Do we know?
We don't yet. You know, it's hard to call a district and be like, hello, does your flagship system not work? It's not a really guaranteed way to get answers. I have not. There's some smaller districts that have had like other problems with Syntegix related to conflicts of interest down in, I believe, like Gilmer County in Georgia. So there are a lot of questions surrounding the company. I just don't know about the functionality of the system.
When Phil Malik asked who we hold accountable, who should be held accountable, was she asking about who within CMS should be held accountable? Or somebody in the company to be held accountable? Or who was she asking that question about?
I think that question cuts a lot of ways. I believe my best understanding about how that thread with the county was going is they wanted to know how to hold the company accountable for not delivering a product. But there are lots of accountability questions raised about the board and the district as well.
So we have to take a break. But Ernest Winston, Superintendent Ernest Winston, has said that if the system is not fixed by February the 10th, he plans to end the relationship with the company and will try to get the money back. We'll talk about the guarantee here, or the lack of guarantees here, when you're talking about $1.3 million when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison is here from our newsroom at WFAE. Annie Maugh from the Charlotte Observer. Nick Oxner from WBTV News. And Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. So we have this $1.3 million spent on a system that apparently doesn't work or works erratically, the security system at CMS. And they have until February 10th, according to Superintendent Ernest Winston, to fix it. Otherwise, he's going to go to them and end the relationship and try, his words, to get the money back. There are no guarantees. Is it normal to put out that kind of money with no guarantees that what you're buying is going to work?
I think it all comes back to the idea that they didn't have the board approve a contract, because that provides a lot of protections. You know, that's what the school finance experts told us, and that's why you would want to do that and not use purchase orders. You know, like I said earlier, they're leaning into the language of the CMS standard terms and agreements, but it's unclear how much power that has.
So this system was put in to be protective of students, faculty, and staff, obviously, but also to allay parental fears because of things that have been going on in the country last year around, and they want, you send your kids to school and you want them to be safe. So when you learn that the system doesn't work and that we have until February 10th for the company to resolve this, has there been parental reaction? Are they worried about this situation?
I have not yet heard from any parents. I think there must be some frustration, but and in fairness to the district, this product was intended to be an add-on to the systems they had in place. And a lot of security experts that we talked to, you know, they emphasize that what goes wrong in school emergencies, it's rarely a failure of technology. It's usually something about like people or policy and practice. So in that sense, I think CMS does have a robust, I've seen their safety plan and their circle of safety. It's very complicated and very strong in that sense.
Well, our Ann Doss Helms reported that this conversation between CMS and the county commission was part of a meeting to discuss county education spending in advance of the 2020 budget. And the agenda allowed 10 minutes on this topic. And Ann reports that when the time was up, quote, CMS board chair Elise Dashue said it was time to move on, even though Leek said CMS had not answered her questions or those that she thinks the public has. And you mentioned that Ernest Winston didn't stay after the meeting and did not take reporter questions after the meeting. Again, optics. CMS seems to be oblivious to the optics of this. Why might we get the answers that Vilma Leek and the public has posed about this?
I'm going to keep reporting on it. I think the entire press corps that covers education here will be, but I don't know whether that's going to come from the board necessarily. But a lot of the things that have come out in the past couple of days, the FBI investigation, you know, was because board members talked to us. So maybe there is a tide turning there, and I hope there is.
Okay. Well, we had four Democratic candidates and one Republican looking to replace Tom Tillis in the U.S. Senate debating here on Tuesday. Was a busy night in Charlotte on Tuesday night. And just as they met, one of those Democrats, Cal Cunningham, already a front runner, launched his first TV ad of the campaign.
When I joined the Army Reserves, raised my right hand and swore to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, I never thought that one of the greatest threats to our country would be the corruption we're witnessing in Washington today.
So this debate was part of a forum presented by the Black Political Caucus of Charlotte. It also included candidates for other offices, and the Observer reported that as a result, Senate candidates didn't really have a time to answer a lot of questions or even to have each of them answer the same questions. Was this a worthwhile exercise? I think you were there, Steve.
I was there. And so, yeah, it was a little bit like speed dating because you had 2.5 hours and you had all these different races. And so it moved so quickly. And, you know, the Senate debate was probably the most interesting and important. And it was, you know, lasted about 20, 25 minutes. And yeah, there wasn't a tremendous amount of substance, but it was the first time that Cal Cunningham and probably his leading challenger, State Senator Erica Smith, had been on the same stage together. And so that's significant. And the primary is in 5 weeks. I think, you know, we're used to May primaries, and it's coming up really quickly. And so there's not a lot of time left to figure this out.
So He already spent some money on advertising, and of course he launched this television campaign, Cal Cunningham has, and Erica Smith You say, I believe, Nick, she's kind of ahead of him or just neck and neck with him?
Well, the race is very tight, right? And this has been an interesting dynamic for a primary because Erica Smith, long been running. Cal Cunningham got into the race a little later than some of the others. And Erica Smith has made it an issue, the fact that she tried to go get the blessing and endorsement of the Democratic senatorial campaign committee, and they threw their weight behind Cal Cunningham instead. Mm-hmm. Despite that, Erica Smith has been polling very well, better than you might expect for someone who isn't the anointed one from the DSCC. And the real difference is going to come down to how Cal Cunningham uses his money in the primary. So that may end up, you can get a lot of extra name recognition, make up a lot of ground in favorables, net favorability, when you blanket the airwaves with your war chest. But that being said, if I'm Cal Cunningham, this primary has been much closer than you'd like for it to be.
I think the most recent poll came out last week by Public Policy Polling. Cal was at 22%. Erica Smith, I think, was at 12. And then a tremendous amount, maybe 60% undecided, which is just kind of crazy if you think about like how little people are paying attention to this race. But the pollsters were telling me that, like, if you go back to 2008, when Kay Hagan ran, at this point in the race, it was a very similar number, a tremendous amount of undecideds. And like Nick said, Cal will now start spending money on TV.
Right.
That's going to be so hard to overcome.
In the national race, Democrats have got to consider which candidate would be the best candidate to put up against Donald Trump if they hope to gain the White House. And, of course, one of their goals is also to take the Senate. They have to consider which of the candidates in this race would be most likely to be Tom Tillis. Have they is because they've chosen Cal Cunningham at the national level, have they already made that decision?
Okay.
Cunningham mentioned in this debate that his military service after 9/11 in Afghanistan, and Smith told the audience that she believes in science because she practices science as a mechanical engineer and that she supports the Green New Deal, while Cunningham portrayed himself as a moderate. What about the others? What did they say?
So there was a very low, small tier candidate, Steve Swenson, who I don't want to use. You could use the word hijacked in a way, because that's what some of the other candidates felt like he did. Trevor Fuller felt like he did. And he talked a lot about the need for reparations, which is a very real issue. But he took over the debate, and a huge part of it was over this issue. And Trevor Fuller said, like, this is not a joke. So some of the candidates on stage were a little bit frustrated by kind of how it was handled.
What did he mean by this is not a joke?
I guess you had to be there. That Steve Swenson, that he was so kind of bombastic and over the top and screaming and shouting about this issue that it felt for Trevor Fuller like a bit of a just it wasn't being serious.
And Trevor Fuller said at that thing that he supports universal health care. Lone Republican in their midst, Sharon Hudson of Davidson, who once campaigned for Tom Tillis but has broken away from him over the toll road issue. What did she talk about?
Toll roads. So, I mean, it was really interesting to be there. And like, toll roads has kind of gone away. It was good to bring that one back, right?
Yeah.
We haven't talked about that in a while. But so she was Tillis does have his main challenger dropped out, but there's still a few. But he has said, he will not debate them in the primary, and he wants debates in the general. But
that's why he wasn't there.
Yeah. Well, and impeachment. But
and
yes,
impeachment,
he would not have been there regardless.
That's right. Exactly right. When David Tepper learned that his MLS expansion bid had won, he just had to share the news with Mayor Vi Lyles.
I called the mayor up, and I said, Mayor, I think I got a present here. I think it's the most expensive present I ever gave a woman in my life.
But it turns out it wasn't his first gift to the mayor. Nick, your colleague at WBTV, David Hodges, reported this week that members of the Panthers football operations staff, including Mr. Tepper, made campaign contributions to Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles and members of city council just weeks before officially asking the city for millions of dollars for their MLS bid. So how big were these contributions and how were they made?
Sure. So Nothing about this is illegal. They were all made legally. We'll say that off the top. The biggest contribution was from Tepper to Mayor Lyles herself. It was $5,200, which at the time was the maximum contribution allowed under the law. He did that, I think, in mid to late August, which is, you know, just a couple weeks before, in September, the Panthers made their official ask for public dollars to start renovating Bank of America Stadium. We also know that Panthers President Tom Glick made a contribution, $500 contribution to Councilman Smudgy Mitchell, with whom we've previously reported, David's previously reported, Mitchell had gone on a trip up to Detroit with Tom Glick. And then a lawyer for the Panthers made a $250 contribution to Larkin Eggleston. All of these legal, all of these properly disclosed. That's how we know about them. But the timing raises a lot of questions.
And Councilman Malcolm Graham was on this program yesterday. So after the show was over, I asked if he had received a donation. He said no, but he said all these were small donations, and all small donations are always appreciated, but they would have no bearing on a council decision, which is kind of what Larkin Eggleston told you. He said the idea that a donation that represents less than 1/3 of 1% of my total fundraising in the last election will determine where I will stand at one of the biggest votes we will take this term is laughable. So, any fire here? Is there really a story here?
I think it's always interesting. And look, when politicians try to start dismissing the amount of campaign contributions, most average people don't have $10 to give to a political candidate, let alone $250, $500, let alone $5,200. I know, you know, that's nothing for a guy like Dave Tepper. But when we start dismissing on size, it raises questions. And I always think it's important to look at where campaign contributions are going, when they're going, how they're being used and funneled. The timing here, to me, appears more than coincidental.
Do we know how these campaign contributions were made? Because Malcolm Graham said all of us have websites at campaign time, and all those websites have buttons that you can push to donate here.
Sure, you send a check.
So if you just do that, the donate here button, you're not really interfacing with the candidate.
As someone who used to run political campaigns, you know who's giving to your campaign, whether they click a button or they give you an envelope.
Okay.
Right.
And I think, I'm sorry, go ahead, Annie.
Yeah. And, you know, like we talked about this with CMS. I think what Nick's trying to say is like the optics of this are one thing, and it's something you have to think about too, right? You might not have a conflict of interest, but an appearance of a conflict of interest raises similar questions.
I think it'll be interesting to see. I mean, going back to like 6-7 years ago when the Panthers did the stadium renovations the first time, Jerry Richardson gave a lot during that cycle. He'd never given before, didn't give since. I'd be kind of curious to see councils up for re-election next year. This won't be an issue. Like, are you still as interested in like supporting your local candidates? Maybe the Panthers will be, but probably you just forget about it.
And again, another thing that the council's done to draw all sorts of scrutiny in every way possible is to have this process that has not been clear or public or transparent at all. They've still not taken a public vote to appropriate this money, even as we're acting like the money's already been spent, as they've announced that it's going to be awarded. They've not fulfilled quickly or completely public records requests. Council members haven't been willing to answer a lot of questions about this, nor has the mayor. And so if you don't want people asking questions about you taking max out contributions from the richest guy in town, maybe, I don't know, try to act with some transparency.
And on top of that, you know, I know I wasn't there at some of these press conferences, but other reporters, when they ask questions, the mayor and other council members have kind of blamed the media for a lot of the scrutiny that they're having, which, you know, ties back into just this idea of like transparency and accountability.
Yep. Meanwhile, Major League Soccer season tickets, I'm told, are on sale. Is that right?
22,000 deposits, right? I think
already.
They felt like the Panthers felt like there was interest here from the surveys they'd done from the international soccer matches. And then Glenn, you said it was 22,000.
I think it's a total out of 30-some thousand. So they're closing in
fast.
That's
impressive. Yes, that's impressive. So and right now, even as we speak, they're conducting a tour of the stadium for the media.
That's right. Yeah. So like,
to what end?
Well, I believe to have Major League Soccer, they felt like the stadium needed certain renovations. They wanted this like center field tunnel because, I guess, in soccer, the players enter at midfield instead of through the corners, so we have to punch some holes in the stadium. I think there were some locker room renovations, some changes for TV cameras and stuff. So they're giving a tour. But going back to what Nick said, this is money that the Panthers are going to spend that the city – in their words, in the city's words, has made this $110 million financial commitment. Is the city going to be helping pay for these renovations? Is it going to go all for this headquarters at Eastland? We don't know because they still haven't released the closed session minutes. It's all very vague.
They've not held even after they said they would, have not held a public session to talk about it at all.
Meanwhile, WBTV is also reporting that City Councilman James Smudgy Mitchell has not filed required ethics forms listing his conflicts of interest since 2018. That's what, 2 years?
Yes.
And he's faced no sanctions or discipline for failing to file this mandatory paperwork. How unusual is this?
Well, these ethics reforms were put in place after the Patrick Cannon charges and debacle were brought about. And the city council at the time said, look, we need to have more transparency so that we can better police our conflicts of interest. David Hodges has been very busy this week on the city council beat. Again, was looking at these forms, first of all, had a hard time getting them from the city, going back to their reluctance to produce public records in a timely manner. And then when he got them, found that some of them were incomplete or missing pages, and then found that there were none for Councilman Mitchell at all for the last 2 years, despite the fact that Councilman Mitchell has not infrequently had to recuse himself from votes, which is a proper thing to do. But we don't know why, because he hasn't filed an ethics form. Councilman Tariq Bakari filled out and submitted his forms after David made the public records request. Side note. The thing that should concern residents the most is that the city told David that they will not investigate someone, councilman, for failing to follow the city's policy unless a resident complains to the clerk. And so he hasn't filed this required form for 2 years, and no one's thought the need to do anything about it.
Well, the recusal aspect of this, he's a business development manager at a company called J.E. Dunn Construction Company, and they hold two contracts with the city of Charlotte. Could that explain his recusing himself from voting on certain things because of his employment there?
Well, it could, but again, we don't know. And one of the recusals involved a property purchase and sale with a railroad. We don't know why. We don't know if J.E. Dunn was developing that. And Councilman Mitchell's refused to answer any questions from David for months now.
And the other one, I was just going to say, the other one, real quick, the other contract that he recused himself on was this Innovation Barn project in Belmont, which was going to be this showcase for environmentally sustainable zero waste businesses. And it was very controversial because it went way over budget. It's been in limbo right now. And that contract with J.E. Dunn is that money's not being spent because the whole project is had big problems.
And these interest forms are required from city council members if they have real estate within the city limits, land leased or sold to the city, more than $10,000 of stock or financial interest in a company seeking to do business with the city, and nonprofit members that serve or do business with the city, just so everybody knows. When we come back, we are surrounded by sanctuary counties. Second Amendment sanctuary counties. Two more came online just this week, and we'll talk about that in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison is with us. He's the co-host of our new Inside Politics podcast, available right now at a politics disseminator near you. And he also is our politics reporter at WFAE News. Nick Oxner is the chief investigative reporter at WBTV News. Annie Ma, reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Glenn Birkins, editor, publisher of QCityMetro.com. Catawba County is now a Second Amendment sanctuary. Their board of commissioners passed that resolution on Tuesday, the same night that the Cabarrus County Board of Commissioners unanimously approved support of its own Second Amendment resolution. Where's this coming from? Why now?
Well, what's happening, and this is something that really bears watching, while Congress has declined to pass any meaningful legislation on gun control, what we're seeing are that states are. Colorado, for example, passed a red flag law, which would allow local law enforcement officials to confiscate weapons in the event that someone might be mentally unstable or there's reason to believe that person might act violently. Some local sheriffs in Colorado have said they're not going to abide by that. So what we're seeing nationally are counties, sheriffs, counties, passing resolutions saying that they're not going to uphold any law that they deem unconstitutional.
This also in response to the fact that in August, Governor Cooper signed an executive order strengthening background checks for gun buyers and called on the General Assembly to consider banning large capacity magazines and some weapons sales to those under 21. Is that part of this as well?
I would imagine that it is. As I said, states nationwide, some states nationwide at least, are starting to move on gun control measures, Virginia and others. And in conservative counties, we're seeing a pushback, kind of like the sanctuary cities movement.
Right.
There are certain liberal or left-leaning regions of the country that choose to ignore certain immigration laws.
Diane Huddycutt, who is the vice chair of the Cabarrus County Commission, explained why she voted in favor of this resolution.
I took an oath to support the Constitution, which includes the Second Amendment.
Yes, and that amendment says a well-regulated militia, let me underline that, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So are we going to be anticipating the announcement of a Cabarrus County well-regulated militia?
I don't think we're going to see a Cabarrus County militia anytime soon.
Catawba County calls themselves now a constitutional rights protected county. They and Cabarrus joining a growing number of counties here in North Carolina moving this way and affirming that local governments will not enact, quote, unconstitutional gun control measures. In Haywood County, up in the Asheville area, Natalie Henry Howell, the mother of Riley Howell, who lost his life in the shooting at UNC Charlotte, told the commission there to give a similar resolution careful thought and, quote, balance the need for self-protection and the need for the protection of others. They're set to consider that Second Amendment protection measure at their next meeting. Gaston County will consider it next week on January 28th, and we will talk with one of the county commissioners who is supporting that measure about why on Wednesday. That'll be the day after that measure is voted on. Where do Union and Mecklenburg counties stand on this?
I don't know. Has it even come up in Mecklenburg?
So, I mean, excuse me. So, no, it hasn't and won't come up in Mecklenburg. Oh. I mean, it just will not, being a 9-0 Democratic majority. In Union, though, I'm not sure. That's a very different place politically. But no, this will never see the light of day in Charlotte. Okay.
It's been cold, although it's warming up this weekend. It's been cold, really cold, the last couple of days. In Mecklenburg County, the City of Charlotte, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Emergency Management Office, the Men's Shelter, and others have temporarily adopted a no-turnaway policy. How does this differ from normal operations? Do they just close the doors when they reach capacity under normal circumstances? So what do they do with the people? I'm getting head nods at the table. It's radio.
Makes for great audio.
But in normal, where do they put the people if they're full up? Where do they put them?
They've been sleeping on cots at both men's shelters. I don't know the numbers, but dozens of people have been forced to sleep on cots on the floor because there were no beds.
Okay. Men's Shelter of Charlotte Urban Ministry Center has also announced plans this week to break ground on a new 196-bed emergency homeless shelter in the spring as a way to provide the services move guests out of homelessness. How will this accomplish moving people out of homelessness?
Well, this is first and foremost, this is going to increase their sleeping capacity, bed numbers, by about 9% at the Statesville Road location. But in addition to just providing beds, they're also providing mental health services, job search help. They're doing a lot of ancillary programs that they're hoping are going to move people or help move people beyond homelessness.
And Honeywell is donating $500,000 to the new shelter. It's part of a $4.4 million fundraising campaign, and if I understand this correctly, they have $2.7 million already committed to the project and hope to have that finished by next winter. But they're breaking ground in the spring, so does that mean by the spring they'll have all the money in hand, or they're starting this on good faith that they'll get that money?
I don't have an answer to that. They are going to break ground in the spring with the hope to have this completed and people actually in the new facility by the end of next winter. What they're saying is that because they're going to build this building behind the one that is currently there, it won't be necessary to displace any of the people who depend on that facility for a place to sleep.
We have been talking about equity in relationship to Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools for years now, and this week the CMS Equity Committee held their first meeting. What are they charged with doing, Annie?
So they are charged with, you know, there was a question of, like, how do you define equity and how do you take 40-something people and form a committee that is effective in answering those questions? And the way CMS has decided to approach this is to break them out into six subcommittees. I can't remember all the topics off of my head, but it's things like student wellness, access to opportunity, school facilities, the kind of things that make up a wholesome education. And people were able to, like, these subcommittees were able to set dates for when they're meeting. It was very bureaucratic, but it focused a lot on, like, specific goals and ideas.
And we've been talking about equity in CMS for years. 20, 30 years, maybe more. And in advance of this committee meeting, the school board itself spent months defining equity. I thought we already had a definition for that. What is their definition for that?
Oh, I'm going to get in trouble because I don't know this off the top of my head. I believe it falls down to the idea that, like, regardless of where you go to school, you will have access to a full and robust education. That is not their exact definition, but it's something along those lines.
Is there a timetable for this to be worked out by the 40 members of this committee?
A big committee. So they, I believe their next full committee meeting is in March or April, and in between then, the small groups will work on their reports, will work on the kind of topics that they've been assigned to, and they are working in an advisory committee, so it's not like they can tell CMS to do things. They can just give them suggestions about what they've been finding.
So for several years now, we've been working on free pre-kindergarten, pre-K for Mecklenburg County kids, 4 years old at that age. And it was reported that just over half of the county's four-year-olds are now enrolled in a free pre-K program. The goal is 80% by 2024. If pre-K is free, why haven't they reached the goal already?
I think at the joint county and CMS meeting, there was some talk about, like, many different free pre-K programs, and there are different qualifications for each one based on income and other things. And there's just some confusion among parents in terms of the messaging of, like, which track do my kids go in? Like, how am I qualified for this? And the county expressed some frustration about that, and they're working to clear that up.
Trevor Fuller said it'd be great if there was one place where families could apply and be told what their children would qualify for. So that's what they're working toward?
Yeah, I think, believe so.
Teachers around the state are being polled right now about their feelings about a strike or what they'd be willing to sacrifice or put at risk to get the legislature to move on some things they've been asking for, including respect and higher teacher pay. They struck last May 1st. Is that the plan this year? Is that what they're asking teachers? Are you willing to march on Raleigh again this May 1st?
I think it has a different tenor this year. Last year, I believe they used sick days or personal leave to just have a teacher walk out for one day. Now, an North Carolina Association of Educators, their survey is asking, like, how many days would you be willing to go? And I think there's just, in a lot of teachers I talked to, there's just been the sentiment that, like, our profession is not respected. There's a court case that says state has been defunding education, and they're trying to measure, like, how much of a show of force they're willing to put out in a state that has no protections for this kind of thing.
The interesting dynamic or kind of development here, last night or two nights ago, sometime this week, the NCAA board met and kind of backed off a little bit the strike. They said, we're going to send a more robust survey to our members, which might suggest that there's a difference, right, between we use sick days or we miss a day and we go to Raleigh, between that, which they've done in the last couple of years, and a full-on strike where we don't show up to work. And it looks like they might be rethinking that a little bit.
Okay. We learned this week that they may be considering demolishing Discovery Place across the street from where we sit right now because the building was designed for a population that has more than doubled since they built the building, and they feel that might be the best way to address capacity issues. But also, Discovery Place is struggling with what's going to happen with the Nature Museum. They're in that 1951 building somewhere in the vicinity of Freedom Park, and they want to replace it with something newer and larger, and neighbors in that neighborhood are concerned about congestion and traffic around that area. And so they sent sent Discovery Place searching for options to what they might do to enlarge that building or move that building. But they've told neighbors this week they're staying put. Why a reversion back to the original idea?
Because there's more nature at the current site. Yeah. I mean, say, if it basically comes down to that. I mean, that, right? Basically, they said there's not a whole lot of nature at Park Road Park.
Well, how can that be? It's a park.
There's more, I guess, in comparing the two locations, there's more nature at the current location.
There are more squirrels. They can come to my backyard.
Also, RIP all of my elementary school dreams and memories of field trips for all the way from Fayetteville to Discovery Place, by the way. But the neighbors are still unhappy. There's a new round of push to get it to Park Road Park even after this week's forum.
But I have to say that that neighborhood, because you were questioning why they need this, that neighborhood it was a nice neighborhood to begin with, but it's become gentrified even more. I mean, the houses there are in the $1 million range now. And the streets are not designed for a lot of traffic, and there's not a lot of parking. And evidently, if you double the size of the Nature Museum there, they don't have room to put a lot of parking. Is that correct?
There's not a lot of parking in the area in general. The park itself attracts a lot of traffic, and then you have the restaurants and shops. When there's a festival there, it requires police trafficking.
So was the only place they looked Park Road Park?
That's the other place that they've been.
But that's the only place they looked. They didn't go to what is it called, Reedy Creek, or some of the other parks around the county?
I don't think so. And I think Park Road Park was even like not even a formal thing. It was kind of thrown out. Matthew Ridenhour, former commissioner, threw it out. Susan Harden mentioned it. So it was kind of not even like a option A, option B. It was just a
not here kind of thing.
Not here, and like, well, what about this idea? You know. So it was so I think they've been stuck on staying at Freedom Park.
And the current location is such a popular park.
Yep.
I would hate to see it leave that location. Actually.
Well, we will see what place they discover. At Discovery Place.
Oh, boy, episode. That was bad.
Thank you very much. City Council approved a plan on Tuesday for Novant Health to build a new hospital in Ballantyne. They rezoned 40 acres on Providence Road west at Johnston Road. How big will this facility be? How many beds?
36 acute care beds, 2 operating rooms, and Novant says it's building it because there's an increase in demand for beds and medical facilities down in that part of the
world. Now, a couple weeks ago, we talked about the battle between the hospital systems and how both Novant and Atrium are petitioning the state to approve 6 new operating rooms and 76 acute care beds. This isn't part of that?
This is separate from that.
Why?
This was approved by the state. So North Carolina has what's called certificates of need, where if hospitals want to build new facilities, get a new big piece of equipment, they have to get a certificate of need from the state that says, sure, we think there's a need in your community for that. So this hospital that's been announced this week or broke ground this week was approved under a different certificate of need. So now the state has said, we see 76 more acute care beds being needed in Charlotte, and both Atrium and Novant have competing plans for how they'd like to use all or parts of that.
Okay. United States senators have been sitting quietly all week in the Senate chamber, listening to the House Democrats lay out their case favoring a guilty verdict leading to the removal of President Trump from office. There's a lot to delve into there, but one of the stories to come out of Capitol Hill this week was that North Carolina Senator Richard Burr, who is not known for wearing socks, is also not wearing socks at the trial. Evidently, a sketch artist captured this in a work of art, an all-important aspect of the trial, and displaying no embarrassment, the senator posted the image as his profile picture on Twitter. We just thought we'd bring that up because the Inside Politics podcast that Steve is the co-host of probably did not. Is that right?
No, we have not gotten into the sock issue. That'll be episode 5. We'll do about an hour on that coming up this spring. But Lisa Wharf and I, our Morning Edition host, we launched a politics podcast. Yesterday, and it's going to look at the Republican National Convention that we're hosting in August, and I think it's a really fascinating going to be such a fascinating convention.
Yep.
With everything going on in this country.
And you'll be back Monday to talk about that in more detail.
That's right.
The Milwaukee Bucks and the Charlotte Hornets are going head-to-head in Paris, France tonight, and the Hornets hope to break their seven-game losing streak in front of the Eiffel Tower. Glenn Birkins, Nick Oxner, Annie Ma, and Steve Harrison, thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.